reset. When the sunrise comes falling, when the midnight comes calling.
Yo, what's good, everybody? It's your host, James Meeks, and we're back for another episode of your favorite Black Fatherhood podcast.
Yes, sir. And what's good, everybody? It's your co-host, Jesse Alex, also the co-founder of Dear Fathers, the premier media platform for Black Fatherhood. Thanks for tapping in.
Before we get into this dope conversation today, I need y'all to go and subscribe and follow us anywhere you get your podcast today. Jesse, let's dive right in, bro. Yo, yo, welcome back to another episode of the Dear Fathers podcast. I'm your host, James Meeks. We're excited about another impactful conversation we have with today's guest. But before we start, I always got to tap in with my boy, Jesse. How you feeling, family?
Man, I'm feeling great, man. I'm excited about the guest that we got on today. My birthday was a few days ago, so I'm still recovering just a tad bit, man. But these conversations are always therapeutic, so I'm excited to tap in today.
Well, happy belated, my boy. I know you enjoyed it. We'll celebrate soon. But getting into the intro for our guest, we'd like to welcome an amazing actor and amazing father, DeVal Ellis of the Dear Father, to the Dear Fathers podcast. How you feeling today, bro?
Feeling good, man. I appreciate y'all having me, Jesse and James. This is a pleasure. This is dope. This is what I'm all about, fatherhood and being a son as well. So any time I get with some brothers who want to talk about fatherhood and how we can be better fathers, I get excited about it.
That's dope, man. And, you know, for us, what really inspired us is being able to, you know, have a platform that showcases men and Black men specifically in a manner that you guys aren't always talked to and talked about, right? So, you know, coming from, you know, your NFL background to now being into the media space, man, a lot of people want to talk to you, a lot of people want to interview you, but they don't really want to know who you are as a father and as a man and as a husband. So we want to highlight that. We don't really focus on, you know, the drama and all the messy stuff people get into. We really want to talk about the great things and really get to know you more as a man. So really leaning into it, man, you know, we want to talk about, you know, your upbringing. Like, let's take it back to, you know, where you grew up at. I know you're from Brooklyn. You know, what your upbringing was like, what your family was like. What was your relationship like with your father?
Well, I actually was blessed. Real quick, when I retired from the NFL, I started a nonprofit organization training young men. And 75% of the young men I trained and mentored did not have fathers. So when I was growing up with my dad, that was my life. I assumed that everybody had their father in their life because that was my reality. You know, that was my normal. So I grew up with a father who was a huge disciplinarian. I grew up knowing both my grandfathers and my step-grandfather. So I had a lot of positive males in my life. And the grandfather that I lived with during the summertime, because I grew up in Brooklyn, grew up in Flatbush, and every summer my parents used to send me to Morristown, Tennessee to stay with my grandparents to keep me and my brother out the streets. So I had an opportunity to live with my father, then live with my grandfather for 8 weeks. And my grandfather was a military man. And it's important for me to say that because he fought in the Korean War, but he was very big on structure. We had to be up in the morning. He taught us how to fish. He taught us how to mow the lawn. There were just certain things that us as young men had to learn how to do because that was the standard he created. He also grew up in Jim Crow South, and we were the only Black family at the time in Morristown, Tennessee, in the cul-de-sac. Mm-hmm. So he kept us in reins. Like, we had to be at a certain standard all the time. And my grandmother as well, she was very big on making sure that we always did things the right way. So I grew up with my grandfather in the summertime. Then for the rest of the year, I grew up with my pops. Both my mother and my father worked. So my brother and I kind of raised ourselves during the year because after school, 3 o'clock, I had to go pick my brother up. Then after picking my brother up, we had to go home. You know, we did things on our own. We were not supposed to be outside, but we were outside. You know, we got on the bus, went places we weren't supposed to go. You know, we were not street kids by any means, but we was in the streets. You know, we had friends from all over Brooklyn and we saw things, but my father was always there. You know, and he always let us know that his biggest job was to provide for us and to protect us. So for me growing up, that's what I saw in the father. My father was a guy that wasn't very emotional. He let us speak our minds and say what we wanted to say, but he was going to tell us how it is, and we were not friends. This is how it is in my house. You either listen to me or you won't be here. So, and same thing with my grandfather. My grandfather was not for dialogue with kids. It was, these are the rules. You follow the rules or you go somewhere else. But my pops was supportive. Anything I wanted to do, he made sure that he found a way for us to do it. And that's pretty much how I grew up.
That's really dope, man. You know, it's an interesting perspective too, because we talk to a lot of cats who, You know, either current athletes, former athletes, you know, but sometimes it's, it had no relationship with their pops. So their pops was there, but you know, the pops was this and they was with their mom. So it's interesting that you had that unique perspective, you know, being around your dad, being around your grandfather, and getting that structure from them, you know, as you grew. So a question I had to kind of dive a little deeper there is, so then as you started to, you know, you became a father, right? And you became a husband. How did, you know, what you went through with your dad, how did that shape who you were going to be as a father too?
So it's funny when people assume that if you grow up with a pops, that you just automatically have this bond with your pops, like y'all two are best friends and everything is perfect and your whole life is just better because you have a father. But it was actually, it was difficult for me and my pops to get along because we're very similar. And being the oldest in my house, my father held me to a very, very high standard. So it seems like I couldn't do anything right in my house. And then I had a brother who was 2 years younger than me, who I was responsible for. And it seemed like my brother could do no wrong. Like it didn't matter what he was doing. He was the baby. He was just, you know, it seemed like they doted over him. And me, it was, you're not doing enough. So me and my father didn't get along growing up in the house. And then as I got older and my brother got older and we became adolescents, me and my brother didn't get along. I think it was just a lot of testosterone in the house and you're constantly trying to figure out who you are as a man while living in a man's house. And for me, that was difficult because I respected my father. I loved my father, but my father also mentored a bunch of young men in the community. And I watched my father give a lot of himself to other people's kids. And I felt like when it came to me, I was just given the discipline. You know, I watch him have grace and patience and understanding with other people's kids. But when it came to me, it was just like, do as I say, and that's it, or it was going to be consequences. So full transparency, teenage years into college years, I didn't like my father.
Was there resentment there because of those other relationships? Okay.
Absolutely. I felt like my father didn't like me as a person. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew he loved me, and I knew that he had an obligation to provide and protect me because I was his son. But I felt like he didn't like me because I used to challenge him. You know, my brother was more like, hey, whatever daddy say, I'm gonna do. For me, it was like, if this don't seem right, I'm gonna ask questions. And I felt like my father didn't wanna be able to answer questions. He was just like, I said to do it. So I don't wanna be questioned by you, you're my son. And then we have a younger sister who's 10 years younger than me, who that's his only daughter. So she could do no wrong.
Yeah.
So I kind of felt like of all the people in the family, I was like the black sheep. So when I had my children, I made a conscious effort to give my children a voice and to try to find ways to make all of them feel special, even though I know that they're all different. And I didn't want one to feel like one was more my favorite than the other. Mm. And I'll be honest, it sounds easy, but I realize how I struggle in doing that now. And I realize why my father was the way he was. Like, you don't realize. You don't realize until you get into that position of fatherhood of what it takes to be a father. Like, there's so many people who come up with ideas of, in order to be a father, you have to do this. And to be a husband, you have to do this. Until you've been in that position of being a father or a husband, you really cannot give advice to people about what it entails to be in that position. And I gained a greater respect for my pops after I became a father.
Yeah, man, that's an amazing story. And we appreciate your transparency. And what I love about the platform and being able to talk to guys like yourself is different perspective, right? Like, like I said before we started, I grew up without my dad. So, you know, me thinking like, as I get older, like, oh, I wish I had a dad in the home, but that don't necessarily would have meant that it was going to be all, you know, good. You know, if I had a dad in the home. And it's crazy because since starting this platform, a few of my homeboys who grew up with fathers, they've opened up to me about them and their fathers not having great relationships. And since, you know, being involved with the Dear Fathers platform, they've, you know, rekindled or reconnected with their fathers in different ways. So it's just kind of crazy to hear those different perspectives. And I know James grew up with his dad too as well. So it's always good for us to share those type of things, man. So we appreciate you for opening up.
Well, this is what I do think people need to understand about being a father. As a father, you have a job. Your job is not to be your child's best friend. And your job is not to make your child, like, I know everybody here has probably seen Fences. And Denzel said in Fences, who says it that I gotta like you?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? My job as a father now with three boys is to make sure my children get home every night, are productive members of society, protect women. If they choose that they want to be, you know, husbands, protect their wives and their children, but to be successful. Yeah. If that means that my sons ain't going to like my methods and may not like me, but they can do all those things, I've succeeded as a father. I really could care less. Me and my kids do not have to be friends. But if I can provide them with a foundation to be successful people and grow up with a certain level of confidence, I'm going to do that. And the thing is, when I first became a dad, I had to get to this point because I had all of these ideas of me and my son being best friends and we doing everything together until you realize there's certain things about your sons that you don't like, that you have to fix. And in order to fix that, that's going to put a little bit of strain on your relationship because you have to, yeah, it's super uncomfortable. And people don't mm-hmm. like to be uncomfortable.
Not at all.
So, and mm-hmm. when you hold them accountable and you make them uncomfortable, they're not going to like you. It don't matter how you say it. It don't matter how you try to, you know, sugarcoat it. No, you're holding me accountable constantly and you're telling me I'm doing this wrong. They're not going to like you. And I've gotten to a point now in my fatherhood, because my oldest son is 10, where I look at him and I tell him, bro, you're not going to like what I have to say. I don't care. You may not talk to me, but it's going to make you a better person. So get it done. And I'm willing to live with that. You know, I'm willing to live with that.
Yeah, and that's powerful, man, especially nowadays. I think, you know, people have gotten so sensitive nowadays. And I get times have changed, people have changed, and everything that, you know, we were raised on isn't necessarily what we should do to our kids. But mm-hmm. I kind of live by that same principle that you're discussing, which is, you know, I have three kids as well. I got two boys and a daughter. My oldest is 11.
Blessings.
And,
blessings.
You know, there are always times where, you know, I'm like, hey, bro, you're not going to like me today. And it's okay. But I promise you, though, we could be cool in, you know, 6, 7, you know, 10 years when you're grown up, mm-hmm. we can shoot the shit. Because then you'll be a man and you'll understand why I did the things I did, why I told you the things I did. Right now, you're not going to get it. And it's okay. I still am responsible for getting you to the destination, which is to be a productive human being and responsible and somebody that's respectful. So, you know, I can't subscribe to all the people who now just want to say, oh, no, you got to be best friends with your kids. I don't think that's realistic.
James, what you said, though, is the key, though. Your children, you're not a man yet or a woman yet to understand my perspective and where I come from. So me even trying to be a friend to someone who's not on my level does not make any sense.
Right.
It just doesn't make, I'm responsible for your well-being. If something happens to you, I'm responsible. And since I'm responsible, we cannot be on the same level. We'll be friends when you're an adult.
Right.
But right now, right. I'm not your friend.
No, I definitely agree with both of y'all. And like I said, I don't have any kids yet, but this having this platform, man, is super therapeutic to me. And it's also a learning experience to me to get to talk to people like yourself, even learning from James, just being on the podcast, hosting it with him, man. So I appreciate y'all transparency. And we even want to just kind of take it back a little bit further, man, to, you know, you play college ball at Hofstra, signed to the Detroit Lions in 2006. At that time, did you know that you wanted to potentially, you know, get into entertainment? And, you know, what was your biggest struggle going from, you know, playing sports into acting?
Football was never my dream. Football was a means to an end for me. And I think it's important for people to understand that, because I was a basketball player growing up, but I'm not tall. And I never thought I was going to be in the NBA. For me, entertainment was the end. Like, I always wanted to be an actor. I wanted to tell stories. I wanted to be an action hero. At one point, I wanted to be a singer and a dancer just because I love to perform, but I can't sing. But I knew that performing arts is where I wanted to go with my life. And that's how I wanted to make my contribution to humanity, was through performing arts. And I knew that I had to get there through going to college and finding ways to get educated. And sports was the way. I was always gifted athletically. My mom's father could have qualified for the Olympics. And I think 1961, but he ended up having my mom. And at that time, you know, athletes didn't get paid a lot of money. So he went and drove a bus and started to do the things a man should do, was take care of his family. So I've always had like super athletic genes. My father's side of the family is super athletic. So after playing basketball, the football coach came over to me and said, look, bro, you're 5'8 at the time, 5'8, 140 pounds. You can dunk. And this was my sophomore year in high school, you can dunk, but how many 5'8", 140-pound basketball players do you know? And I was kind of like, not many. He said, if you want to go to school for free, you should try to play football. I didn't really watch football like that. I didn't play football. My brother was a big-time football guy growing up. So he started showing me videos of Peter Warwick at the time, who was 5'9", 185 pounds, just killing people. And I loved Allen Iverson. Then I found out that Allen Iverson played football in high school. So I was like, you know what? I could do this football thing. Ended up earning a college scholarship. I was a walk-on. Nothing in my life was ever easy. You know, I broke a bunch of records in high school at the receiving position, but I was small. Ended up walking on the Hofstra, broke a bunch of records, thought I was going to get drafted, but I didn't. And then ended up playing in the NFL. And I remember at the time, me and my wife were just dating. And she said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I was just like, I want to do that. And Martin was on TV. And she was like, oh, word? And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. I want to have my own sitcom. I want to do da, 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 da. She's like, all right, well, how you going to do it? And I told her, I said, you know, if I make it to the NFL and I just make the practice squad, I make $90,000 in 4 months. With that down payment, we can get a brownstone. We can live in the basement. We can rent out the up two upstairs family floors, and I don't have to be a starving artist. At least we won't have to worry about rent or mortgage. And she was like, cool, cool. That's what's up. So, you know, me and her started putting our plan in place. I ended up getting to the NFL, and I'm a super competitive person. As soon as I got to the NFL as a free agent tryout, pretty much the same as a walk-on, like less than 1% chance of making the team, I ended up making the team. They had 4 first-round picks at my position, and I was just super competitive. Like, I just wanted to show people I belong there. So I made the team. I ended up having a bunch of injuries, so my playing time was limited. Like, I was on the field, off the field. And then after dealing with a pain med addiction after my second year because of, you know, all the injuries and trying to get on the field, I just decided I didn't want to play no more. I had made enough money to buy some properties like I said I wanted to do. Started my business back in Brooklyn, and I said, let me focus on TV film. And I tell people that story because so many people don't realize that sports is a vehicle. You know, for a lot of Black men, it's always been like your escape out of the hood or out of your situation, and that's all you can do. You know, we see it with guys who've made billions of dollars. They're still telling LeBron James to shut up and dribble. You know what I'm saying? And for me, I like to tell that story because I want young Black men and young Black women to realize your body is a commodity. And a lot of times they want to utilize your body for their entertainment. But if you realize what your body can do, you can utilize that as your vehicle to get what you want out of life. And that's what I did. I got my education paid for. I had a nest egg to start my business, and I got into TV film. And the transition for me was a little bit difficult because when you're playing football, they create a plan for you. You know, like you're the guy. So, okay, these are your classes. This is what you do. If you want to go from high school to college, you go to these events, you get scouted, you do this. But when you want to start a podcast or you want to start writing or you want to be an actor, there's no combine for that. Like, there's nothing that says, here's the blueprint. So the transition was a little bit difficult, but I used my business acumen to be able to provide a lifestyle for my family while I was learning a lot about the business. And I ended up, you know, building what I have now. I call my little media empire, my wife and I, you know, where we do the podcast, the YouTube channel, we're both doing television, both have done films. So it's been kind of dope.
Yeah, nah, not even kind of, bro. Like, yeah. That story is dope, man. Don't even be modest, man. We definitely gonna pat you on the back here because that's dope, man. And 2 things, man. It's, I want to salute you just on having that plan at such a, you know, young age. Because, I mean, you coming up with that idea, what you was like 19, 20 or something like that?
Yeah, I was 18 when I sat down with my wife and I told her exactly what I wanted to do. And this is where I'll give a credit to my pops. My father always put me around people that were different. So I grew up in Brooklyn, right? And you grow up in Brooklyn, you're going to see drug dealers. You know what I'm saying? You're going to see thieves. You're going to see stick-up kids. Well, a lot of Brooklyn kids don't get a chance to see other Black people be successful doing other things in life. And I remember meeting people through my father and through our church, shout out to Salem Missionary Baptist Church, who owned real estate, you know, who went off to college, who started businesses. My older brother, my mentor, Sean Freeman, he went to Hampton University and started, got into finance. So in my mind, it was like, oh, I see people do this, so I can do this. So the idea of me going to college, going to school for free and then owning a building, renting out the upstairs floors and my uncle did that. My uncle was a police officer. He was a police officer for 25 years, but he owned property. So, and this is my mom's brother. So for me, it wasn't far-fetched. And I have to credit my parents for putting me in a position where I could see things. Because once you can see it, then now it's, oh, that's a possibility.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times for young Black men and women, we don't see things. So to the idea of doing something other than what we see on television,
right,
which is rap, sing, play football, drugs, it's like, oh, I could never go to college and own my own building or own my own business. I could never, because I don't know anybody who does that. But for me, that was my reality.
Yeah, that's really dope, man. And I think, you know, to Jesse's point, man, really just kudos to you for having the foresight to, one, establish a vision, you know, based on what your pops exposed you to, and then, you know, praying about it, and then going and doing the work to get it done, man. You know, at 18 years old, to say, look, I'm going to go this way because I know I want these other things for us and our family. Like, most 18-year-olds don't even have it in them to think about the world in that way. They so focused on you, because you could have been like, you know what? I want to be the greatest football player of all time. I want to play in the league for 15, 20 years, and not even have thought about stacking money, putting money away so you could do other things with it. So just major shout out and kudos to you, bro, for having that foresight and that look ahead with the vision. And it's, you know, it's really dope for us being fans of you and your platform to see how you had that back then. You now what, just turned 37, I think?
37, yeah.
Yeah, so to turn 37, now it's come full circle 20 years later, and the vision that you set forth and had 20 years ago is actually here. Now you live in the things that you said you was going to do, so that's really dope, bro.
Yo, it's funny to hear you say that, because when you're in it and you're constantly working, even my wife tells me, like, you don't take no time to celebrate the victories. And that's because I'm always working towards the next thing. But when I think about it, then that was 20 years ago that I said I wanted to do this and I'm actually here. Even hearing you like speak it and say it, it is overwhelming to me, because it's kind of like, dang, I actually really did all of that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a testament to people who are listening to know that just because you want something doesn't mean that it's going to happen in a year or two or three. You grind it for 20 years and now you get to really realize, and you're not even done yet, but now you get to realize the fruits of your labor. So, you know, I just let like everybody who's listening, like, let that be inspiration to you. Like, you pray to God for whatever it is you want. You got to do the work, but you don't know when it's going to come. So you can't give up on yourself.
That's absolutely true. I heard a saying that says it takes 10 years to become an overnight celebrity, you know, because once you become popular or become celebrated, people only go back to when you started. They don't go back to where it really began. It was like, oh, DeVal booked the show with Tyler Perry. Oh, a year before that, he wasn't doing nothing. Man, look at that. Rags to riches in a year. No, it was 10 years before that that I had started, and I was doing commercials, and I was, you know, filming myself and doing young films, doing student films and making no money. But y'all saw 2018 to 2019, but didn't realize I retired in 2010 from the NFL. Right. So it was a long journey, and that's key. You know, like, things don't happen in your time. They happen when it's right.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt, man. And a testament to you just, you know, having the wherewithal to stick through all that, you know what I'm saying? And make everything happen. But we kind of want to even go into your acting a little bit deeper, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you play Zach on BET Sisters. What's that experience been like for you being on that cast?
Bro, it's, first of all, shout out to Mr. Tyler Perry and everybody at TPS Studios, because what they have done, once again, opening my mind up to the possibilities more than just being just an actor. Like, when I got into this industry, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do in it. I knew I wanted to act, but seeing everything they do at the studio made me realize, like, oh, there's so much more. But we film completely differently than any other production in Hollywood, right? For example, if you do a 10 episode show, typically that takes anywhere between 10 weeks to 12 weeks to film. You know, you normally have for filming 1 to 2 weeks per episode. Sometimes even if you have 10 episodes, that may film 20 weeks, right? We film 25 episodes in 10 days.
Wow.
What?
Yeah, you think, yes. So it don't even sound real. I'll tell you a funny story. When I first booked this, I had just booked another TV show, Bigger, on BET Plus right before that. And I did an episode, and I was there to film for the episode for 2 weeks, for one episode. So I find out that I booked this show, and I'm like, damn, I'm excited. And they're like, okay, your start dates for this season is going to be the end of July. It's going to be the end of July to the middle of August. So I'm like, oh, these are my start dates. Boom, I'm like, cool. So they just gave me a range of where we're going to start. I call one of the producers, and I'm like, okay, so, you know, should I block out my schedule till maybe November? Because you said we're doing 25 episodes. He said, no, we'll be done in August. So I'm like, oh, so we must just be shooting the pilot. I'm like, we could possibly only shoot the pilot. She said, no, we got 25 episodes already ordered. So I'm like, so we're going to do 25 episodes in the 3 weeks? And she was like, it won't take 3 weeks. And I'm like, what? Like, make it make sense. Then I get there and I see, once again, Tyler Perry's genius. He has a whole studio, 330 acres, right? Which was once a Confederate Army base. So you think about the historical context, right? This is a Army base, Fort McPherson, that was once created to keep Black people slaves.
Yep.
Is now owned by one Black man. And he owns the entire studio. This studio is larger than all of the major studios in America combined. Warner Brothers, Paramount, what's the other major studio? Universal Studios, all of them. He's bigger than all of them. And I get there and he's created a world inside of the studio. And even that, or even with those world, every show has like a sound stage that you can go from one thing to another instantly. TV shows don't have that. Typically you film on location. And when you film on location, the reason why things take time is because you can only be at this location for a certain amount of hours. Then you got to come back. Then you got to do transport. But the way he's designed it is almost like, a soap opera where we go from location to location to location to location in a day. We may do 4 locations in a day and it's instantaneous. And he has a very particular shooting style with cameras that move, and he directs. And since he's a writer, he doesn't have to constantly write and direct and go back and ask for approval. So everything happens like in real time. But you as an actor have to be on point. And this is one thing that I say to people when it comes to working for TPS. If you're not prepared for that environment, you're going to fail. And you're going to struggle, and it's going to come out on camera. Very similar to the NFL. The NFL, you have 4 weeks to prove to the GM on that team and possibly 31 other teams that you belong in this league. They give you a playbook that's this thick, and they say you have to learn everything in the playbook to get an opportunity to go out there and play. And those who get it, swim. Those who can't, sink. And it's the same thing at TPS. So for me, that time I spent in the NFL learning, it was like the same type of environment when I got to TPS, and then I was able to be successful in it, and so was the cast, because we put the work in, and I'm excited to be a part of the show. You know, it's the number one rated show on cable television. We average over 1 million viewers per week, which is like dope. Cable television does not do 1 million viewers per week, but Tyler Perry's shows do, and I'm excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, I watch Sister, so I'm familiar with your character on there and in the show and the crazy things that go on. I haven't gotten into Bigger yet. My girl, she watched Bigger. I think, and that's coming back pretty soon too, I think.
Oh yeah, it actually came back the 22nd, April 22nd, okay. It came back.
Yeah, yeah, I got to tap into that. But yeah, I'm a fan of Sisters. We watched that. You watched that, James?
Yeah, yeah, we watch all of that, man. My mom is a huge Tyler Perry fan, so anytime he got a show coming on, I got to watch it just to be with my mom. So, and then I think, man, for the community, I just think we got to protect Tyler Perry, man, because what he did, absolutely, just to your point, Jesse and I both used to live in Atlanta. I went to college in Atlanta at Georgia State. So when I first moved to Atlanta, my pops, he was in the Army. So I used to actually go to Fort McPherson to like get my groceries and everything and take them back to my dorm. So to see that he bought all of Fort McPherson and turned that into his own studio, like that's monumental. And I don't think people talk about that enough.
No, I don't think they will talk about it enough, because it goes against the narrative that they push forth for Black men. You know, they love to push forth their narrative about us because they want to constantly dehumanize us, right? And if you think about the history of this country, the history of this country was built, or it was stolen land that was built on the back of immigrants, you know, imported immigrants. They treat us like property. We were imported immigrants built here to cultivate the land and give the land value during the Industrial Revolution so that Europeans could make money. That's ultimately what the American way is. And it hasn't stopped. You know, it's just changed. If you think about slavery then went to vagrancy, to convict leasing, to Jim Crow, the war on drugs, to now mass incarceration. All of that is just a different form of slavery. And I think it's important for us as Black men to teach our young Black men what the game is. Because if they understand what the game is, they'll know how to maneuver in this system if they choose to live in America. Because you can't survive in America without living within the system and finding a way to maneuver it and change it from within. So when you look at someone like Tyler Perry, And he was homeless at one point, writing scripts out of his car, to now owning Fort McPherson. How do you tell a mass of people who believe that this group of people is less than human that this is what this guy is doing? It doesn't work. Yeah. It doesn't work for what they want to do in America. So it's never going to be published. They're not going to talk about it a lot, but that's what we should do as Black men. We should celebrate each other. And the same thing for Black women. We should celebrate them and all the achievements they've made over the last 200 years, you know, since we've, it's about 200 years since we've been free, quote unquote, after slavery.
No, no, you made great points, bro. So definitely enjoy learning more about your background, bro. But we definitely want to get into, you know, who you are as a father, because I think that's, you know, a lot of us see it. If we watch the Ellis's, we follow your Instagram. But tell the people who DeVell is as a father.
It's difficult because you can watch me on Instagram and it's entertainment for me. You know, people ask me all the time, why do I share? I share because it's entertainment. Another quick story. When Jackson was 4, I was on season 2 of Power. This was after doing The Blacklist, after doing Mysteries of Laura. And I had co-star roles. And in all of the co-star roles, I played an ex-con. And Jackson sees me in Power. I'm once again in jail. Tommy comes up and I curse at him. The fuck you looking at? And Jackson goes, damn, daddy, you always got on that orange suit. So I was like, yo, like at that point, I was like, it's enough. Like, I can't perpetuate the same stereotypes that I don't want my son to feed into as a child. And at the time, he was the only son that I had. So I had made a decision to write my own sitcoms and put them on social media because I wasn't getting the opportunities for the roles that I wanted. So when you watch the Ellis's, understand that you're watching, it's entertainment, number one. It's a form of reality TV because some things you watch are what we're doing, but I have to protect my family. So you may get a 1 minute video, a 2 minute, 3 minute video, but that's less than 1% of what happens in this house. And when you're watching it, understand that you're watching me be a father to my kids, but there's so much more to what I do to parent my kids than what you see on social media. And I have to say that because sometimes people don't get it. You know, like me and Jackson will have an interaction and he'll say something slick or funny. And I think it's funny and I'll put it out there. And then you'll see a comment where someone was just like, oh, he just lets Jackson say whatever to him. And I understand that that's what you see, but I need people to understand that that's all you see. Like, you know, it's a 1 minute video. You know, there's thousands of minutes in the day. So there's plenty of time that you don't get a chance to see me actually parent. But DeVell as a father is a disciplinarian. Like I said, I grew up, my grandfather was a military guy. I grew up in the football sports environment. So I'm really big on structure. I'm really big on creating an environment of adversity for my boys within my house so that when they step out into the world, they're not caught off guard by how difficult the world is, especially for young Black men. You know, I have 3 young Black men, and regardless of how much money I make or they make, when they step out in the world, people are only going to see them as young Black men. So me, I'm purposeful about creating a callus around my children so that they walk out in the world and they feel protected. So, and this is some of the things that you will not see on social media, because you'll see me be the happy, doting father and I'm silly and stuff, but not for nothing, that's is bullshit. You know, when it comes to really what being a parent is. That to me is entertainment, to also break the narrative that Black men are not involved. You know, so when I put out this content, I want people to see me and see me be loving to my children, because I am loving to my children. But there's a lot more hours that people don't see where I get a chance to parent. You know, like, for example, Jackson and Cairo have to get up at 7:30 every morning. They have to work out. Why do I do that? Because they have to learn that you don't get to wake up when you want to wake up. We're doing distance learning, right? Jackson was going to school in California. We moved to Atlanta, so he don't have to start until 11:30. Am I going to let my son wake up at 11:30 to start training, just to start workouts? No, you have to be up. So 7:30, you get up. I need you to brush your teeth, wash your face, get dressed, get your brother dressed. I give them all accountability. And when they come downstairs to start working out in the gym, and the reason why I'm saying these things is because I didn't grow up like this. I didn't have a gym in my house. I didn't have my own bathroom. Like, these are things that they're privileged with. So when they come downstairs, if everything is not perfect, your shoelaces are untied, go back upstairs, start all over. You know, you come back downstairs, did you brush your teeth? Oh, I forgot. Well, go back upstairs, start all over. And some people may say, damn, that's harsh. You know, he's four and he's only 10. That's harsh. Yeah, that may be harsh to you.
Right.
But I'm a Black man growing up in America. Everything we do, we have to be 10 times better in order just to get an opportunity. So I'm creating that type of standard for my sons early on so that when they step out in the world, you'll never hear, oh, my bad, sir, I was only 5 minutes late. My sons won't be late because they're not allowed to be late here. Oh, my bad, I didn't have a proper shirt to wear in this interview, so I just wore this. My sons are never going to believe that that's okay. If they're ever going on an interview, they're going to know that they have to set the standard before they even walk in the room. Fatherhood starts from this age. I'm not going to wait till they're 13 and go out there and make mistakes. I'm the type of father that's going to instill a lot of things into them, but also give them grace when they do make mistakes. I grew up getting beat. Like I said, my grandparents grew up in Jim Crow South. You know, my grandparents are literally one generation away from picking cotton in Orangeburg, South Carolina. So they raised my parents, spare the rod, spoil the child. So they raised us the same way. I got hit with fly swatters and belts and slippers, and I got hit for doing children stuff. You know, like you sitting at dinner, you and your brother playing, you knock over the juice spill, everybody getting their ass whooped. And when I got older, it sounds funny, but that's the truth. When I got older, I asked my grandmother, who God bless her soul, she's alive, but she's suffering from dementia. I said, Nana, why do you like hit us all the time? Like what? Like why do we got to get hit? And she said, DeVal, you're here for 8 weeks. We're the only Black family in Morristown, Tennessee. My job is to get you back home to your parents safely. When I was growing up, a young black boy who steps out of line, looks at someone the wrong day, can be up on a tree. And I was like, dang, that was her reality.
Yeah.
So the only way she could keep us in line was to make sure that she, you know, gave us that little bit of pain before we went outside. You know, so if you're about to step out of line, you get hit. And we don't live in the same type of environment anymore, but things are still very similar because if you're riding in a car, and trust me, being a young Black man in Brooklyn, dealing with stop and frisk, driving an Audi A7 when I was 26 years old, I dealt with a lot of fucked up police, pardon my French. I got taken out of my car. I got put on the front hood of the car. I got put in handcuffs. I had to sit out there for 30 minutes in a t-shirt in the dead of winter because they wanted to prove a point. And this was in 2010, 2000.
Not that long ago.
That's not that long ago. So for me, when I'm raising my boys, I'm raising them with the same type of awareness. My boys are not going to have the freedom as other white kids to go out there and make mistakes and just so happen to, I messed up. Call my dad and he'll fix it. No, you make a mistake out here, it could cost you your life. So I'm very deliberate with how I the approach I take to mentoring and being a father. But I'm also very loving. Like, I don't hit my kids. I don't. If my sons don't understand something, we're going to sit down and have a conversation. I don't care how long the conversation takes. It may take an hour. It may take 2 hours. But we're going to sit down and come to an understanding before we move on. Now, when my boys were real, real young, you know, small things. You boiling water, don't touch the water. You're going to constantly go over to the water. I'm going to pop you so that you don't go over there and spill all the water on yourself. You know, I'm that type of father. I'm going to pop you to let you know. But the days of taking out a belt, beating my boys, and all that, I'm not doing that. Like that type of trauma, I'm stopping it in my generation. I'm not doing that to them. But I do rule with an iron fist, and that's a lot of stuff that I can't show on social media because we as Black men will get judged differently.
Yeah,
if I show absolutely. How I really parent, people go, he's too hard. He's too hard on my kids. So I gotta show the loving aspect, which I don't mind.
Yeah, now we appreciate that, man. And I respect you for setting that standard for your kids because like you said, when they go out into the world, you know, the world not going to give them as much grace. So just having them prepared is the best thing you can do. And we want to kind of take it back, man. And I think you actually shared something about this on social media recently, but we have a written storytelling series that we do called Dads in Delivery. The reason that we started that is because not a lot of men get to share how they feel physically, mentally, and emotionally while in the delivery room. It's always
y'all doing some good stuff. Cause dude, that's y'all doing some good stuff, bro. Go ahead. My bad. I didn't mean to cut you off. That's good.
No. We appreciate that, man. We definitely appreciate it. But yeah, it's called Dads in Delivery, man. So if you could take us back to, let's take us back to your oldest, the first time you was in a delivery room, man. If you could share you know, just what you felt physically, mentally, and emotionally.
We had three different birthing experiences. And our first one, we went to the hospital. I was at the gym training a bunch of kids. I get a call from Kadeen, and Kadeen says, hey, babe, they think I may have preeclampsia because I had high liver enzymes. So they're going to have to take Jackson out. They're going to have to induce me to go into labor. So she was at 37 weeks. So I'm like, okay, is everything okay? Are you cool? And she's like, yeah, I'm fine. So I leave the gym. I head over there. I'm still in my gym outfits. Like I said, I'm 27 years old, young black kid. Kadeen is young. She's 27. And I'm like, how you feeling? Feeling good. She's in the hospital. Nurses and doctors, we've had the GYN has been good with Kadeen the whole time. But of course, our GYN is white. And we go into the process of inducing labor. When we get to the process of inducing labor, they start with the epidural. Kadeen sits at the edge of the bed. She's nervous. They pull out a huge needle. I go in front of her. I'm nervous. I'm nervous as hell. I see this needle. And when they pull the needle out, my friend, and I have tattoos. I've never been afraid of needles. They pull this needle out, legs weak. I'm like, oh, Jesus. I'm like, hey, I'm going to be back. She's like, you better not leave me. So I'm like, okay, I'm here. So now I'm holding on to her. She's sitting there. The lady, the anesthesiologist, sticks the needle in her back and then pulls it out. And then Kadeen like screams like, ah, and I'm just like, what happened? What happened? And then the anesthesiologist is like, she's moved. She moved. I'm like, she didn't move. I'm standing here the whole time. Like, she didn't move. Indian, older Indian woman. Kadeen is sitting there. They go to give her the anesthesia again. The lady pulls it out. Kadeen shouts. And I'm like, yo, lady, like, now I'm getting pissed. I'm about to turn into the angry black man in this hospital. I say, yo, that's the second time you stuck my wife with this fucking needle. And I know at this point that's, you know, no one ever wants to speak to a woman like that. But my wife is sitting here at the edge of the bed and she's about to start crying. She's trying to keep it together. And I said, you got one more time before I ask for somebody else. Like, I was pissed. So then the lady finally gets the needle in there. Kadeen screams. And then the lady's like, it's in. So I'm like, how do you feel? She's like, I feel okay, but I'm numb in my right leg. I'm just numb. I can't feel anything. Me not understanding how any of this works is like, oh, that must be what happens when you get an epidural that makes everything numb so that you can give birth and not feel no pain. So I'm like, okay, you cool. You know what I'm saying? They set everything up, tape the needle, do everything, put it in her back. And now, you know, we're going through the process of waiting. Kadeen and I were up all night. She's smiling. She's trying to keep a happy, you know, happy face. I put a picture of Michael Jackson up on the wall because that was a guy that I was inspired by. He was a very peaceful guy, big on humanity. I'm like, focus on Michael Jackson. That's how our son's name is Jackson. So I'm thinking I'm doing everything that I can. Me and her up all night. Finally, she falls asleep. I don't fall asleep. I'm looking at her the whole time, just watching and make sure. Because it's nerve-wracking as a father. There's nothing you can do. You're right in this room and there's beep, beep, monitors. Everything's going off and I'm nervous. I'm just like, you know, I just want to make sure that my wife is cool. My baby is cool. Rolling around 9:30, Kadeen is up. Doctors come back in. The doctor says, look, she, you know, she's dilated. Everything is going good, but it's going to be a couple more hours. Kadeen's, you know, moving around. She's like, I feel a little uncomfortable, you know, a little uncomfortable. I feel like some pressure's going on down there. The doctor's like, you know, just chill. You'll be fine. I'm going to go, you know, get a quick coffee when I come back. I said, you're going to leave now. She says she feels uncomfortable. Doctor said, yeah, she'll be fine. She got a couple hours. You know, we put the epidural in, blah, blah, blah. So I said, cool. Kadeen sits up in the bed. She looks at me. She said, Deval, I think this baby's coming. I go pull up the thing. I see the crown. I see my son's head, curly hair, crowning. So I'm like, okay. I'm like, go get the doctor, get the doctor. Doctor runs back in here, telling her to push. I'm holding my wife by the head. The doctor's telling her to push. Kadeen pushes two times. Jackson flies out. Boom. So now Jackson was born with a club foot. The doctor, the nurses, they all grab him and take him to orthopedic because he has a club foot. They have to make sure everything is good and straighten it out while his bones are still malleable. So now it's just Kadeen and I in the room by ourselves, and she's looking like super gray and green. And I'm like, you know, baby, you all right? And she's just like, yeah, I'm just tired. But she couldn't, like, she was slurring. She couldn't finish. So I pull up the gown to see how everything's going. Blood is just gushing out of her, just gushing. And I'm like, her mom is a director of nursing at a nursing home. So I call her. I'm like, Ma, can you come look at this? My mother was there too. Kadeen's mom comes in there, lifts it up, screams out for the nurse. Nurse, nurse, nurse. The nurse runs back, looks under there. I hear the doctor say, prepare the operating room. I'm asking, what's happening? Like, what's the matter? What's going on? Nobody's answering me. What's happening? What's happening? All I remember at this point was my mom grabbing me, and then I blacked out. I don't remember. I was like nervous. I didn't know what was happening. My mom grabbed me, blacked out. All I remember is sitting there, and it was that moment. Then I wake up and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, Mom, what happened? What happened? And she was like, you need to calm down. I don't know what happened. She's like, you just need to calm down. Kadeen is going through surgery. She'll be out in an hour, blah, blah, blah. So I'm sitting there and I'm thinking in my mind, I haven't seen my son. I don't know if this is the last time I'm ever going to see my wife. Because you hear all the time about women dying during childbirth. So I'm instantly like nervous. And I'm like, even thinking about it now is getting me kind of choked up, because this, when it comes to women, people don't put enough value onto the process of bringing life into the world and how have to put your life on the line every time you bring a life into the world. And I'm thinking like, please do not let me lose my wife. And at that moment, I said, if we get through this, I'm not having any more children ever again. Like, that's what I was feeling at the time. Doctor comes out, says, Kadeen is stable. She was probably 3 minutes away from needing a full blood transfusion. She didn't need a blood transfusion. She had a cervical tear, which required 27 stitches, which is why she was bleeding, which typically, you know, something like that can cause hemorrhaging, and she could bleed out. But they got it. They saved her. She was in there. They finally brought her out. And I watched my wife like a freaking warrior. The minute she comes out, you know, she's out of the anesthesia and everything like that. And they give her my son, and she's just like, it's almost like a superpower. Like, it's almost like none of that ever happened. And she's smiling. And I have the picture. I keep the picture of my son and my wife, and I'm sitting there, and I'm right behind them, and I'm smiling. But I remember feeling so helpless. And I said at that point, I'm never, ever, ever going to be this helpless in this moment ever again if Kadeen decides to have more kids. So for 4 years, we decided we was not going to have no more kids. Like I didn't want her to go through that. And then finally, she said, you know, she thinks she wants another one. And at that point, I made a decision to learn a lot about maternal health, prenatal, postnatal, postpartum, especially during birth. And that's when we decided to do everything all natural. So she didn't do it or do anything with an epidural. I found out that what happens is the epidural slows down the birthing process. Because she couldn't feel anything and because she got stuck three times, she had probably some nerve damage, which affected her legs, which is why she couldn't feel anything. So she didn't feel when to push. So she was just pushing when her body was telling her not to push, which is why she had a cervical tear. So I said, if we're going to do this again, we're going to do this without any medicine. And we're still going to go to the hospital. And then with Cairo, we labored at home. I walked around with her. I did a ton of research, read a bunch of articles, and I prepared for it. And Cairo almost came out in the car. Like, we did everything perfectly. Cairo almost came out in the car. There's a video on Facebook, actually the first video that ever went viral from us, where right after her delivery, she was just like nothing ever happened. Like, it was like she didn't have a baby. And then at that point, we decided with the third one, we was going to do everything at home because we didn't have to go to the hospital. They charged us $25,000 because she had the baby in triage. They didn't do anything for us. They didn't give us no medication, no nothing, but they still had to make their money. I tell any parents, watch this documentary called The Business of Birthing. And it's a documentary about how they utilize hospitals to make money because people are born every day. So in that moment, that's when I realized I had to be a greater partner as far as being involved in the birthing process. So that was my first experience.
Really, that's a unique story, a very traumatic story. I'm mm-hmm. glad everything worked out in the end. But, you know, just what I think is powerful that I took from that is like the research that you went and did, you know, for future birth, future children you were going to have, to make sure like you guys fully understood, you know, what they were going to put into her body, what you didn't want put into her body, and how that was going to impact the process. Because I could tell you, as a father of three, going into it the first one, I knew nothing about any of that. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. like, I sat there and watched my wife, who wanted to go natural and not take any drugs. She didn't want to get an epidural, and they was like trying to force it on her, and I couldn't mm-hmm. understand. So I'm watching her struggle in pain, and then like they keep coming back in like, well, nah, you should just get the epidural, baby, get the epidural. I'm like, why do they want you to get this so bad? Maybe it'll help you out. But then all the horror stories that I've seen and heard from people who've had children, and it's all typically related to the epidural is like the linchpin every time. And you made a good point when you said that the epidural, you know, slows down the birthing process. But then they try to give you like Pitocin, which is supposed to speed up your contractions and all of that. So it's conflicting stuff going into your body, which just really isn't natural. And women, they're vessels for life. They're here to give life. So we get in the way of that when we add all these drugs on top of it.
And I think people need to understand that even the birthing process in America, like you go to a hospital, you fill out a bunch of paperwork. So it's almost like they got you locked into a contract. If they're not going to force the epidural, the next thing they'll do, if they can't get it fast, is they're going to force you into getting a C-section. And the Black mortality rate for women in hospitals is, I think, 3 to 1. 3 to 1, even though we're only 15% of the population. Now, think about that. We're 15% of the population, but we die 3 times higher than any other race in this country, which is ridiculous. But also shows you the lack of care they have for our women when we go into the birthing process. On top of that, if you look at how the birthing process works, you're never supposed to just sit back and lay down while birthing. You're supposed to stand up, walk around, be bent over a different way. Like, there's so many ways to speed up the birthing process without giving medication, which ultimately you pay for, or getting an epidural to numb the pain, which you pay for. So I've just learned so much about it. And we've been blessed. Our last 2 births have gone amazing. You know, we've had no complications. Kadeen has been a warrior. She's had it with minimal bleeding and has been able to be active the very next day. So I'm a big advocate for understanding women's maternal health, especially Black women's maternal health as a father. Like, it is important for us to know, because fatherhood doesn't start when the baby comes out. It starts from the moment you've conceived and you realize, like, you know what? I'm responsible for this vessel that's carrying what's going to ultimately be my legacy when it comes out. So there's so many things that we as fathers need to talk about. For example, I have 3 friends who are currently expecting, and they call me probably weekly. Bro, when your wife was pregnant, was she doing this? Did she have an attitude? And I was like, yes, bro. Yes. It's not just your wife. It's part of it. Give her some grace, bro. But I don't, bro, listen, you do not have to carry a human in your body for 10 months, bro.
Nope.
Whatever you're going through right now, trust me, she's going through worse. Give her some grace. And it's being accountable for each other. And also, when they don't feel like it's just their wife, they're a little bit more like, you know what? Yeah. My wife ain't the crazy one.
Right.
It's the process. And that's what we need to have. We need to have these open conversations and say, you know, I haven't had sex in this amount of times. It's because she's fucking pregnant, bro. Like, she doesn't want to have sex, bro. But the doctor said we can still have sex. I heard what the doctor said.
Right.
But she doesn't want to have sex. Like, that's, and it's not just your wife. You know, I understand how you feel. You may feel as a father, because these are things that men won't openly discuss, and they won't say it out front of other men because they don't want to seem as like they're being super emotional. There's times as a father, especially during the pregnancy process, where you feel underappreciated, you feel taken for granted, you feel like you're not wanted around, and you're asking yourself, like, I'm trying to be as involved as possible, but she's pushing me away. A lot of times that happens during the pregnancy process because women are hormonal, because their body's going through changes. They have their own issues they're dealing with outside of the hormones, but also there's a little bit of resentment that comes towards men from women because they have to carry the body and you get to go. You get to go outside with your friends. You get to have an escape for 10 months. My wife, for the last 4 months of her pregnancy, for the last 2, could not sleep at all because she couldn't get comfortable. So imagine dealing with sleep deprivation for 4 months and you get to watch me sleeping. Like, you literally look over and your partner that got you pregnant is knocked out and you can't sleep. Of course you're gonna
make them want to slap you upside your head right there.
You know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? Like, I made a joke on Instagram one time. It's like, if you really want to piss your wife off when she's pregnant, just go somewhere and take a nap. You know, and people was laughing, but it's true though. Like, I used to stay up with my wife, and it sounds like people are, he's lying. I'm like, yo, my wife sometimes be up to 3-4 in the morning, and even though I had to go to work, I didn't want her to feel alone in those moments.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what you want to watch? You want to watch Chopped? All right, let's watch Chopped. I hate this show, but if this is what you want to watch, and she'll sit there with me, we'll make jokes, but I'm like, hey, if she going to go through a little bit of struggle, let me do it with her. And if we as men have these conversations, men won't feel like it's just my wife, you know?
Yeah. Nah, that's dope, man. We appreciate you just kind of opening up about that, because that's exactly why we started the platform, man. Our mission here is to inspire, heal, and strengthen the Black man. And I think a lot of times, you know, what comes with that is just having the knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. One of our goals, like I said, we got the Dads in Delivery storytelling series. But one thing that we do actually want to do here at the platform is create like a workbook for fathers to learn about the birthing process. Because a lot of times that, you know, it's just a lack of knowledge. So we appreciate you sharing that, man, because you just doing that work to kind of figure out what's going on, you know, with your wife and in the birthing process is, you know, what we all need to be doing. So even, you know, going to move into, you know, just kind of talking about, you know, your balance of it all, you know, mm-hmm. you're in the entertainment industry, you're an actor, you know, you do all these things on social media. You also do work with your wife. You guys got a podcast together. How do mm-hmm. you balance all that while, you know, just being a dad? Because it seems like, you know, based on what you're saying, you're a super active father. You set the standard. Yeah. So how do you balance all that shit at the same time?
Number one is I don't know. Like I'm just being honest. Like every day I wake up, and you can ask my wife and my manager. I'll wake up and I'll be like, what I got today? Mm. You know, like I have calendars and I have alerts, and my wife sets up a lot of that stuff. My manager sets up a lot of that stuff. Even today, I completely forgot that I had this interview till about 2:45. I got an alert, right? Because my two kids in New York. I'm still training one of my homeboys whose wife is pregnant. So me and him have our therapy sessions. My wife had to go out. So I'm in the middle of, Jackson still has distance learning. He calls me. He's like, daddy, mommy went out, but I'm supposed to get lunch. I'm making lunch. Boom, I get an alert. Oh, you know, so yeah. I can't sit here and act like an expert. Like I got it all figured out, because I don't. But I will say this. I delegate certain responsibilities to certain people who I trust, which is like my village. Having a manager was something I never thought I would need. I'm like, I got everything up here. And it wasn't until I had three kids and a wife and multiple businesses that I realized that someone has to tell me where I need to be if I'm going to be in creative spaces, because I can't be in creative spaces worrying about everything. So I've learned to let things go and delegate. Also, I've learned to trust my partner. My wife is way better at doing certain things than I am. And I've learned to allow her to be really good in her spaces and not worry about it. I used to be a very controlling person, like because I've only been able to be successful in my life trusting myself. So when you get married, the hardest part sometimes is learning to trust your partner. Because anytime you want to get something done, you're like, man, I can do it the best. I learned how to trust my partner, trust my business partners, and also learn how to just say, you know what, this can wait. Because we as people tend to think like, if this don't get done right now, the world's going to come to an end. And then you do it, and then something else comes up, and then you do it, and before you know it, you've forgotten certain things. For me, fatherhood is always going to come first, because my sons did not ask to come here. They're here because of the things that I decided to do. So everything else has to stop when I have to be a father. My manager knows that. My businesses know that. Even at TPS, I can, and this is what I love about Tyler. He'll have something planned. He'll be like, hey, we're trying to do this and do that. And I tell him, like, you know, I got this for my son. And he'll be like, cool, we can work around that. You know, and I got comfortable being able to tell people that my kids are going to come first. You know, back in the day, it used to be, man, you're a man, you go to work, let your wife handle all that. Now, be comfortable telling your boss or whoever you're working with, like, hey, I gotta get my son from practice. People will find ways to work around your schedule if you're good at what you do. So that when you get to work, you got to deliver when you get there. So I would say a key is scheduling, having clean communication between you and your partner and your business partners, and also just being deliberate about the choices you make, because people find time for the things that's important for them. So if fatherhood is important for you, find time to be a father. Don't always say business comes first. You know, so that would be my keys. And hopefully it works out, because there's some days I wake up and I feel like I'm doing a terrible job. Like there's some days, even now with all this I got in place, dad will be like, hey, my Jackson will be like, hey, dad, you forgot. You said you were going to do X, Y, Z. And I'd be like, damn, I really messed that up. And he'd be like, yeah, you said you're going to do it last week too. I'm like, damn, you know, like But those are the things that you can't see on social media. Like, I'm not going to post my son being disappointed because he had to wait 2 weeks for me to set up his bike. Like, there's nothing in that for me. So I may make a post or two about it, but there's nothing entertaining in that. So, and I don't want my son to be disappointed on social media, but there are times where I'm disappointing as a pop. Like, and that's okay for all the other fathers out here to hear that. Like, you're not always going to be on point. Like, it's just not always going to happen. And you have to learn to give yourself grace and learn from those moments and say, you know what? I messed that up because I did this. Let me not repeat that behavior.
Yeah, that's dope, man. And to your point, we talk about that often. It's about giving yourself grace. Give other people grace, but then always give yourself grace and don't feel like you got to be perfect because you're going to mess up. We learn as we go. That's just who we are as humans. So, you know, do the best you can and understand that, you know, you'll mess up, but you'll figure it out through time. So one of the things we also want to talk about, man, as we get close to wrapping up here, is we have a special segment where we give fathers a chance to write a letter to their father. So hypothetically, if you were to write a letter to your father, starting with "Dear Fathers," what would you say?
I would say, "Dear Father, thank you." First, because I don't think I told my father that I appreciate him enough when I was growing up because I didn't understand what he was trying to do. So I would say, "Dear Father, thank you for giving me perspective. I am who I am because you put me in position to see things." He literally put me on his shoulders so I can see the world from a greater perspective. Because as a child, when you're smaller, you can't see over the wall. You know, you can't see further past the horizon because you can only see what's in front of you because you're so small. And a lot of time, fathers will stand in front of their children to protect them, but not realize that while you're standing in front of that child to protect him, you're limiting his vision of what he can see. You know, it's only, you know, pretty much like you're coddling them and you're going to put them in a bubble. My father put me on his shoulders. He allowed me to make mistakes. He let me see the world. And he created this person that I am today, even in his flaws, because he was flawed at times as a father, but even in his flaws, he created this person. So I would say, "Dear Father, thank you for everything." That's what I would say.
That's amazing, fam. And you know, I think, you know, we all have experiences with our dads, and you know, there are things that we went through that, you know, we didn't appreciate, we didn't like, we didn't enjoy. But you know, to be able to come back as a man, as a father yourself, and to thank him for, you know, everything, the good and the bad that you went through, I think that's amazing. It just shows that, you know, the relationship that, or the things that he tried to instill in you have actually worked out for you. So that's really dope, bro. So before we get out of here, man, we definitely want to give you a chance to tell people how to follow you on social and what's next for you, bro. What's next for you and the family? What y'all got going on? What can we expect?
Well, first thing, you can follow me on social media. That's I Am Deval, IamDevale on all platforms. You can check us out on YouTube, The Ellis's. And right now I'm in the process of writing my second children's book. The first children's book I wrote was The Ellis's and the Time Machine. Why Do I Have to Say Black Lives Matter? Inspired by my son. And my wife has a children's book she's releasing, which is the activity book to that book. So I wrote a book. She created a coloring book, crossword puzzle, so that you can apply the lessons you learn from that book. And real briefly, that book is about Black history. It's pretty much explaining to young children why we have to say Black Lives Matter. And it's explaining the legislation that has passed from 1619 all the way until 2020 when I wrote it, that pretty much 400 years of the United States government telling us that we didn't matter. And I think it's important for Black people to understand this, but not only Black people, everybody, because there's been a lot of controversy over the Black Lives Matter movement and the Black Lives Matter phrase. One thing I will say about the phrase is that we all need to learn to say it, because Black people have been marginalized and disenfranchised in this country since its inception in 1619, then in 1776. And if you want to teach people about racism, don't teach them hate. Don't be biased. Teach them history. So I really want people to learn. Check out this book. It was number one on Amazon when it first came out. It was inspired by my son. It can be heavy for kids who are under 7 years old, so I say between ages of 9 to 13. This is the book for you parents. You can learn a lot about it as well. It's a big history lesson. And that's it for right now. Kadeen and I, you know, Deadass Podcast is still out. We're in season 5. Episode 7 should be coming around. You know, Webby Award winning podcast. Just signed a deal with iHeartRadio. So we're excited about that. Appreciate it. You know, we're building our legacy. We have ownership of our podcast. A lot of people, they get to a point where they want to move up, you know, and they sell so that they can get more money up front. Kadeen and I decided that we weren't going to sell. We were going to keep our ownership and continue to have royalties when the podcast is done. So shout out to my business manager, Denora Bodega 7, for helping us hook all that up. And we're trying to build this generational wealth. But before I leave, shout out to James, Jesse. What y'all doing here is dope. Like really, really dope. Normalizing conversations about fatherhood, Black fatherhood, but also taking that conversation and actually creating something that people can walk away from. Like you said about taking that information and having people being able to do workshops on the things that they hear, because you can hear it, but you now have to apply it. Right. So shout out to y'all too for being deliberate. Being brilliant, you know, and also just being aware of who you are as Black men. Shout out to y'all, man. Yeah, that's dope. Like I'm proud to know you guys, and hopefully we can build from here, because this is fire.
Yeah, no, man, we definitely appreciate that, man. I definitely want to build outside of just this conversation, because I think the conversation is just the start, right? We have to continue having conversations in different spaces. Like I said, we got a mental health group session, we got a book club, we got these different resources that we have, because like you said, we want something tangible for people to take away outside of just hearing the stories. We want them to be able to, you know, learn and grow. And like I said, heal too as well. So we appreciate, you know, your support, you coming on and tapping in with us, man. These conversations are always super therapeutic for me, but this one was even more so therapeutic because I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And just kind of, you know, getting, you know, obviously we see what we see on social media, but like you said, there's more context to who you are as a Black man. And as a Black father and a husband, we appreciate you for taking the time to share your story on our platform, man. We want to get you some merch too. I'll get, you know, address for you.
Get all that stuff. Send me stuff. I got y'all, man. Okay. I appreciate y'all. And I think I'm following y'all on Instagram. I'm gonna make sure.
It's Dear Die Fathers. So Dear Die Fathers on IG, man. Yeah, we'll tap in with you there too as well.
Send you a message, man. And I just want to say to you, bro, because I think as Black men, we gotta say this to each other more. You know, I'm proud of you, King. Look up to you. I'm inspired by you, your wife, what y'all do, man. A lot of what I do and what my wife do, we were inspired by the Dead Ass Podcast. You know what I mean?
That's so what's up, man.
I'm just excited to see. When you made it on the Breakfast Club, I was like, God damn. they done did it now. They on the Breakfast Club. I'm telling you, man, like we lit up when we seen you on there, bro. So I'm just proud of you. Keep doing what you're doing, man. In the same way, we got to protect Tyler Perry. Got to protect y'all too, man, because y'all Black royalty for us, bro.
Yeah.
That means a lot, man. That means a lot, bro. I appreciate y'all, man. Thanks. Hey, yo, what's good, y'all? This is DeVal Ellis, and you rocking with the Dear Fathers Podcast.
Thank y'all for listening to another impactful conversation on the Dear Fathers Podcast. It's your host, James Meeks.
And your co-host, Jesse Alex. But before we get out of here, make sure you subscribe anywhere you get your podcast, and we'll catch y'all next time. Salute.
My own CD cover. I'm so focused as Steven Glover. Still up and coming, but for sure coming. Went out on a limb like I broke something. Watch how he recover.